Dr. Don DeYoung is the chair of the Science and Mathematics Division at Grace College in Winona Lake, Indiana. Don is beginning his 42nd year of service to that institution. Since I've had some students that have not made it through 42 minutes of a class, that's pretty amazing, quite an accomplishment. Don has a bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD in physics, his PhD from Iowa State. He also has an MDiv from Grace Theological Seminary. Don was one of the principal researchers on the Creation Research Society's RATE project, Radioisotopes of the Age of the Earth, and he actually created the popular level book, the account of that groundbreaking research, entitled Thousands, Not Billions. Don is the author of numerous books, featured in a number of videos. As a matter of fact, tomorrow night's video presentation, Dr. DeYoung will be featured in that also. When Dr. DeYoung and his wife Sally arrived last night, they'd had a long drive, to be sure. And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, I'm so glad you're here to welcome me. You know that presentation you gave last time we were together?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you have a copy of that?" I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I do have that. I usually carry that on me all the time." And he says, "Oh, this is so great." I said, "What exactly are you looking for?" And he said, "It's been such a long, hard week. I just really need a good laugh." I'm honored to introduce my friend and colleague, Dr. Don DeYoung.
Well, thank you, Gary, and thank you, folks. It's an honor to share with you for a couple of days. I just thought, since it's like a Monday and we're on a campus, we ought to have a little Monday quiz on astronomy. So I have three questions here, but you're welcome to check with your neighbor on this. It's just kind of one of those open quizzes. So thinking about space, question number one, what month are we closest to the sun? Okay, can you think about that a few seconds? You can check with your neighbor. What month of the year is the Earth closest to the sun? They must be trick questions. So are you thinking June or July? It doesn't going to work. We're actually further from the sun in the summertime. We're closest in December and January. Something's backward here. Distance does not really affect our seasons. It's the tilt of the Earth. So we're actually more distant from the sun right now. Question number two. If the sun were hollow, like a basketball, how many Earths could fit inside of it? Make the sun hollow, poke a little hole in it, and then could we fit a whole world inside the sun? Some of you folks have done some traveling. You know this is a big planet we live on. Okay, can you turn to your neighbor and get a number here? How many Earths could fit inside the sun? I hear 100, I hear 1,000. What is this, an auction? I'm hearing 1 million over here. If you do the math, 1 million Earths would easily fit inside the sun. They'd rattle around like little BBs inside a basketball. It's a million, give or take. You know, scripture calls the sun the greater light that rules the day, and it really is greater. Of course, the sun is not hollow like a basketball. It's filled with chemicals and radiation and energy. And speaking of energy, the sun gives off more energy in 1 second than mankind has produced since creation. Every second. Now, someone said maybe it recovers at nighttime. But no, the sun just keeps on going nonstop. And all I can tell you is the fuel tank is still full. God's provided the sun with plenty of energy for this whole age that we live in. How you doing? I got a third question here. How many stars are in the solar system? I hear a lot. Are the answers always millions with this sort of thing? How many stars are in the solar system? Well, of course, the answer is one, uno, because this is the solar system, and that's the sun. Now, that's an average star, and there's lots more, like in the galaxy and space, but there's one in the solar system, the one that we need. Well, that's enough of our quiz. Give yourself a good grade on that. I thought, again, before we get into the more technical study. I got a few alphabet letters on the board for you, just to kind of summarize things. Some of you know what these letters stand for, and other may be new. There's different creation groups around the country and around the world today, and it gets kind of confusing. So I thought I'd just kind of do a little bit of a summary here. In fact, let me start with the bottom. This is a creation group called Creation Ministries International. They're actually headquartered in Australia. This is a worldwide movement that we're into, and at least their name is relatively new, so that's 2006, about 7 years old. Next, we have AIG. That's Answers in Genesis. That's the group with the Creation Museum. They're going to build the Ark. That's Danny Faulkner's group as well, and they've been around for a while. It's like their 19th year. Answers in Genesis. Now, all these groups are kind of like sister groups. There's plenty for everyone to do, and different ministries. Next up, we have ICR. Do you know what these letters stand for? This is the Institute for Creation Research, and they've been around for a while. What would that be, 41 years, ever since 72? They were out there in San Diego. Now they've moved to Dallas. That's those pioneers, Henry Morris and Dwayne Gish and such. And then the one at the top there, CRS. It's the top of the list. This is the Creation Research Society, and started way back in 1963. Now, this is 2013. Do the math. This is the 50th anniversary. It's the oldest group in the country and still going. And all the other groups have kind of split off from it over time. So these are all wonderful groups, but the CRS is kind of special, 50 years. In fact, there's a sheet that you have in your handout there that talks a little bit about this society. So I just wanted to give you a little commercial. In fact, several of us are on the board. Gary Lockler is, and Danny Faulkner and myself. And it's just all kind of a volunteer basis to kind of keep this thing running. This is the group that you join. It's a professional society, although anybody can join. And we have several different features that we're into. We publish a technical journal called the CRS Quarterly. It's been coming out for 50 years. It's a good high stack of material. And we kind of do this research, and then the other groups popularize it and get all the credit for it. But that's okay. That's the way we are. We try to keep a low profile with the CRS. We have other publications. There's one called Creation Matters. We put out a newsletter. We publish books. We have funds, and so we invite applications for creation research. When you get into this area, you know, you don't just close the books and close the lab and say God did it and go home. It opens up all kinds of new areas to explore that people haven't thought of. Creation research goes on, and so we have grants for that kind of stuff, whether it's studying plants in the desert or the layers of the Grand Canyon or the star clusters or whatever. We also have a small laboratory. It's out there by the Grand Canyon. It missed the fire that they had out there, and it's a place where scientists can stay for a period of time and do research as well. So all that's kind of going on, and there's our website at the bottom, just a little commercial of one of these neat groups that is carrying on. Let me say, when I joined the CRS, got on the board back in the 1980s, I met some outstanding leaders who were pioneers of this whole creation movement. And three names come to mind. Some of you might know these names. There was Bill Rush, who was on the CRS board, and John Klotz, and Paul Zimmerman. These men in particular were pioneer Concordia educators and scientists and church leaders, and it's been a real privilege to know them. Lutheran talent has played a major part in the modern creation movement and in the CRS. So this is kind of neat to have these meetings here at Concordia this week. Well, we're going to go on here. We need to talk about the moon for a while. And someone says, come on, that's one little speck. We need to talk about all of space. Does the moon deserve a whole talk? Well, I think it does. It really is our nearest neighbor in space. And, you know, there's lots of speculation to these days on where the planets came from and the galaxies and deep space. We better start with our nearest neighbor, the moon. And there's some questions right there. I'm not sure we have a right to speculate on the origin and all the details of the whole universe when we haven't gotten to the first base talking about the moon itself. Let me just mention a few basics of the moon here, just kind of a review for us. Of course, the moon circles the Earth in roughly 1 month's time, and it goes through its phases. This week, we have that waxing crescent moon in the sky. I don't know if we'll see it. It's kind of cloudy, but that's a great time of month to look at that neat moon. The moon's about 250,000 miles away. If a flashlight would shine at the moon, it takes light about 1.3 seconds to get there. The moon, 1.3 light seconds away. The moon revolves, going around the Earth, and it also rotates, spinning on its axis, and both times are about 29 and a half days, as seen from the Earth. It's locked in. For that reason, the moon always keeps the same face toward us. Have you noticed? The moon has a hidden side that we never see. Well, space probes have looked at the backside. It doesn't look that much different, but it's kind of locked in. The near side stays toward the Earth all the time. The moon is about one quarter the size of the Earth. I was just trying to compare here. It's sort of like comparing a basketball with a baseball. I guess that's why we say the moon goes around us instead of vice versa. We kind of outweigh it as well. Now, on the moon, you can walk around there, and gravity is about one-sixth of what it is on the Earth. So if you go to the moon, your weight, you'd divide by six. Wow, instant weight reduction. If you weighed 150 pounds on the Earth, how much would you weigh on the moon? Divide by six, about 25 pounds. I don't know if those astronauts could enjoy that. They had the big spacesuits on, were kind of bouncing around, but there's just lesser gravity on the moon. The moon, no liquid water, no air, no blue sky, no breezes, no sound. It's kind of like a museum as it just stays up there from day to day. Well, we are going to think about the moon for a while. And just to kind of get into some parts, let's get these three aspects. Let's think about the origin of the moon, where that thing came from, and just how old is the moon, and then some design evidence that show that the moon was put in the sky there for us. So the origin of the moon, first of all, how did it come to be circling us in space? I got to tell you, a lot of ink has been spilled on this question of the origin of the moon. In fact, way back in the 60s, July 69, that's 44 years ago this month. Some of us are old enough to remember this. The Apollo project, 12 astronauts walked around on the moon in the 60s and early 70s. We did go to the moon. We left instruments up there that are still being monitored. And part of the whole drive for this Apollo project was to figure out the origin of the moon. Now, we have the biblical view that God played a part, but, you know, in this technical age, we need to have our own explanations. And so, again, that was one of the reasons for going there and studying it. And over the years, there's been different ideas, different theories of how the moon got to be in the sky. So let's review those a bit. Back in the 60s. Well, the majority view back then was the fission theory. Now, I don't know, what do you see here? A chicken drumstick? Do you see a bowling pin? No, this is a serious theory. The suggestion was that long ago, in the early days, before anybody had evolved on this Earth yet, the Earth was actually young and molten and it was spinning real fast. And a bunch of material kind of fissioned or broke off from the Earth and became the moon. It fissioned off. Pretty exciting story. It'd be fun to stand back and watch that happen. Now, this theory was actually first proposed by George Darwin, one of Darwin's 10 children. Some of them lived and some of them didn't, but George Darwin was a scientist of his day. So this was his theory. So this fission thing goes back quite a ways. Well, it doesn't work very well. And this theory has kind of come and gone. What did I say that the moon had, that the Earth had to be spinning rapidly for this to happen? Now, you can do a little math on this. And what you'd have to do is take the gravity at the surface of the Earth and then set it equal to the centripetal force and then calculate how fast the Earth would have to be spinning so that you might get spun right off like a child off a merry-go-round. And if you do that, it turns out that the Earth would have to be turning in about 1.4 hours for lunar fission to occur. But the Earth turns in 24 hours. It goes much slower than this, and so this doesn't look very likely. The Earth has missing spin, and I think George Darwin realized that, but it was the best theory that he could come up with in sort of a, in sort of a secular way. So that's one basic problem of fission. The Earth doesn't go fast enough. And by the way, those rocks that they brought back from the moon, they don't look exactly like Earth rocks. There are some chemical differences. It does not look like the moon came from the Earth. And if that's not enough, there's other problems. There's something called the Roche limit. If a moon comes close to a planet, if it comes real close, then the planet's gravity will shred the moon. The gravity will be strong enough, it'll pull it to pieces. And you see, with the fission theory, the moon had to be close to the Earth at one time when it left. and so the moon would have broken up. I guess we would have a ring instead of the moon that we have. So anyway, these are all problems with the fission theory. So it got replaced in the 1970s by what's called the capture theory. The suggestion this time is that the moon just came here from somewhere else. Thank you. And so it comes from the bottom of this picture here, and it drifted close to the Earth, and we reached out with our gravity and captured it, and it's been going around us ever since. That's an interesting one. Not really an origin theory, but we'll give them that. It still doesn't work. Now, if a moon would come close to the Earth, it definitely would feel our gravity, and it would make part of that outer turn on this picture, but after about a half a loop, you know what it would do? It'd be gone. It would take off. Actually, it would pick up speed like this red arrow shows, like a stone out of a slingshot. Now, to capture the moon, you would have to slow it down, put on the brakes, carefully insert it into orbit. And how do you do that with these natural origin theories? So this is another temporary theory that went away as well. There was another thought I was bringing up with this, to slow the moon down and put it in orbit, it doesn't seem to work. You know, things move rapidly in space. Remember back in February, that meteor that came down into Russia, hit the ground and knocked some buildings over? That's a typical speed of something in space, and they say that was going about 41,000 miles per hour. Well, to get the moon to go into orbit, in fact, the orbit speed that it has is also on your picture there, about 2,200 miles per hour, much too slow. Things in space just move too rapidly to get captured. They come and go. So that Russian object that came down kind of showed us that point as well. And another problem with lunar capture, you'd have a lopsided orbit if the moon came in and somehow got trapped by the Earth, but the moon's orbit is quite circular. Its eccentricity, as they say, is only like 0.05. It's only about 5% off from a perfect circle. And so it's that neat orbit that we have. It doesn't look like some kind of random capture that occurred back in the first place. Hey, we're looking at the origin of the moon, and so much for fission, so much for capture. Now, here's the one from the 1980s. We're going right down the line here, and this was in all the books, the nebula theory. Now, nebula just means, you know, something's nebulous, a cloud of gas or dust. And so the illustration here is a couple of gas clouds side by side. And the thought is gravity took over and it just collapsed these two things. So there formed the Earth and the Moon. It doesn't work either. In fact, there's still a lot of nebula in space that we look at with our telescopes. But you know what these clouds tend to do? They tend to spread out, to dissipate. With this theory, you wouldn't get either one, an Earth or a Moon. But there they are. And there's also just orbital problems with this theory. How is it that these two clouds collapse and then you have the moon going around the Earth in this nice orbit that it has? There's an angular momentum problem. I'm running through these moon origin theories and it's getting kind of, nothing seems to work. It gets kind of negative. Because these have all failed, let me show you the latest idea. This has kind of hung on for a while. And so what astronomers are saying these days is maybe it was much more dramatic than these kind of theories. Maybe there was a catastrophe. And so the current view, they call it the giant impact theory or the collision theory. And the suggestion is that long ago, this huge space rock came down and struck the Earth. This thing was as big as Mars, they say. And it hit the Earth so hard that it fractured the surface of the Earth. And a bunch of these fragments flew up into the sky, and then they coalesced together to make the moon, and the rest of the Earth kind of tumbled back together. They haven't figured all the details out yet. But this is the collision theory. And if you would kind of Google today, origin of the moon, this is the one that would come up. It doesn't work either. They all fail. In fact, if the Earth would get hit with something of this size, there would be so much kinetic energy, so much heat, that the whole crust of the Earth would melt. And we don't have a magma ocean that turned to basalt. It doesn't look like the whole Earth was hot at one time. That's a problem. In fact, some of the computer models of this collision of an object with the Earth, they show that there should be two moons, if anything, but we just have this one majestic moon. And so, likewise, this collision theory goes away. Have you caught a trend in this stuff? Fission, capture, nebula, collision, and waiting off stage would be the next theory. Each one of these lasts about 10 years, about a decade. I've been watching this stuff for a while, and these theories roll on by. I think that the Creator made the planets and space and the moon complex enough to defy every natural origin theory that we come up with, and that's the way it is. And it makes a person want to humbly speak up after a while and say, maybe we can't explain the moon. You know, maybe there's some intelligent design here. Maybe the moon was placed in the sky. Now, I know that's not science as it's defined today, that it has to be naturalistic, but really science is a search for truth. And if that leads you to a supernatural creation of the moon, so be it. And I think it does. We'll have to move on from origins here, but to me, creation makes good sense. In fact, I think there is design evidence of the moon as we're talking, and as Scripture even says, there's no excuse for missing the evidences that God had a hand in the whole area of the moon. Oh, I had one last picture here. An artist has drawn kind of a conception of what it would look like when this big thing hammered the moon. That would be exciting. You know, but again, creation is not like that. God did not make these random collisions that are going to destroy the earth. He's got his own plans for the future, and so artists can draw it, but it's not necessarily true. There's another quite quick list of all the origin theories, and I don't know what the next one will be called, but it'll be coming along here in the next decade or so. Well, so much for origin. Let's move on next and talk about the age of the moon. Just how old is this object that circles us? Now, if you would look this up in the books, the typical value today is about 4.5 billion years. I just put that at the bottom of the picture, sometimes 4.6. That's said to be the age of the moon and the earth and the planets, the whole solar system, kind of on that age. None of us can comprehend a number like that, 4.5 with all those zeros in it, but that's just the typical value they use today. I think that this ancient age for the moon needs to be challenged. And let me just think of a couple of areas that just raise a question about this ancient age of the moon. In fact, the first question involves something called recession. What we have found is that the moon is slowly leaving the Earth. Every time it circles the Earth, it moves further out. Have you noticed the moon getting smaller in the sky? You say, I don't think so. No, because it's quite negligible during our lifetime. But it is getting smaller. Now, this is kind of a complicated picture, but in the upper right there, I have that the current rate of recession is about 1.5 inches per year. With these sensors that were left on the moon, we can measure that. I mean, in 10 years, that's 15 inches. In 100 years, it goes up. This is winding outward of the moon. It's slowly leaving us. Now, it's due to a tide connection between the Earth and the moon. As we pull on the moon, it's slowly spiraling outward. But to think a little bit more about this recession, that's mighty small, 1.5 inches per year. Let me say that it wasn't always that way. It's not linear. 100 years ago, the moon would have been a little bit closer to the Earth, and then it would have been moving faster. And if you extrapolate back in time, the moon is closer to the Earth, the tides, the gravity connection is stronger, so then the moon moves faster. And I don't want to do too much with numbers here at this time of day, but if you could just look at the upper right part of this thing, again, DRDT is just the rate of recession of the moon as it's moving away from us. And in that first row there, I have the distance of the moon today, just R, the Earth-Moon distance. And there it is, 1.5 inches per year. There's some equations behind this that I didn't want to bring up here today. But if you take those formulas and you put in the moon only being half as far from us as it is, like one half of its current distance, then the moon was moving at 68 inches per year. And if you make the moon 5 times closer to us, the number goes up steeply. This is greatly nonlinear. The point again is that the Earth moon would have been moving a lot faster as it was closer to the Earth in the past. Anyway, this lunar recession is kind of interesting when you think about this. By the way, those equations, if you want to go after them, there's a reference at the bottom. This is the Creation Research Society Quarterly, and there was an article back in 2008 spelling out all these kinds of details. Here's the bottom line on all this. If you put the numbers into this recession thing, then you find out that the moon must be less than 1.5 billion years. In fact, it can't be anywhere near that. But if you take the numbers and put them into the formula for how gravity works, in about 1.5 billion years, the moon would be right here. It'd be right up against our nose. It'd be right at the Earth as it's moving away from us. Well, you can't do that. You can't have the moon anywhere near the Earth because it would be broken up. It'd be that Roche limit type thing. And so this is a fundamental problem with evolutionary time. They're at the bottom of this thing they call deep time, that the moon is 4.5 billion years old. It can't be. It can't be anywhere near that old. Again, that 1.5 is an outside limit. I'm not saying that the moon is 1.5 billion years old. I'm just saying it's got to be less than that. That's what this recession thing seems to tell us. I don't know if you followed that argument, but it's a strong one, and I've never really heard a good reply from the deep time people. Now, I got New Scientist, this magazine, and this is the issue from just the month of May, and they had an article on this. And here's what the person says. He was struggling with this area. Perhaps the moon moved a lot slower in the past. Well, perhaps. But that doesn't go along with the equations, because all of our gravity theory shows that it moved faster in the past. So they seem to be stuck with this. I think that the moon is a witness to a recent supernatural creation. And there's my 1.5 outside limit, which is about four times less than they say. There's something about the moon that's a witness to a recent creation for the Earth. Anyway, this is one whole area then called recession that's kind of interesting. Let me mention another area. This involves craters. Now, the moon is said to be little changed during our day. It's typically said, if you look this up in an astronomy book, that there was a period of intense cratering which occurred about 4 billion years ago. This is close to, you know, when the solar system came together, as they say. They call it the heavy bombardment period. The books would say that today the moon doesn't get hit by anything. It just sits there. It's a museum. And all those craters that we have are from the distant past. And it does just seem to sit there. Are there any major craters on the moon that are still forming today that might challenge this idea that it's been sitting there for 4 billion years? There is evidence that the moon is still active and that it's still being hit by craters. In fact, let me mention one example. Now, this is a lunar impact, an eyewitness testimony, and this does go back a little bit more than 800 years ago, but that's nothing compared with these billions of years. And this goes back to Middle Ages, medieval time, when apparently there's a record, a testimony of people that were looking at the moon and saw a major impact occur. That's not supposed to happen. Nothing's supposed to have happened for billions of years. There's writings of this. This is in historical time. And here's what the journals say from back then. Just after sunset, it was reported by five men that the upper horn of a new moon split. And from the division point, fire, hot coals, and sparks spewed out. What were people looking at back then? They did see something happening on the moon. Now, this is before the time of telescopes, so we just had some moon gazers at that time. And I think that a horned moon is probably a crescent moon, and somebody saw something happen up there. As far as we can tell, where this new crater formed is actually on the backside of the moon. Now, this picture kind of shows the Sea of Crisis. If you can see where the red arrow is, this is the side of the moon that we can see. And right around the right-hand edge there on the hidden side of the moon is where there's a fresh crater. So even though it was out of sight, I don't know what they saw. Just the heat, the energy, the dust in the air. It seemed to envelope the moon for a while. And so there's some this kind of record for this. Now, of course, these days we can circle the moon with our probes. And here's a picture of what it looks like. They've named it Crater Bruno. And this has got the most recent crater. It's about 12 miles across. And there it is. And they get these close-up pictures of it, kind of showing that it's fresh and young and recent. I think things are still happening today. And this kind of just challenges the idea that the moon has been sitting for a real long time. Here's just another picture of it. And by the way, if you want to do some more research on this whole thing, there's an article in the Quarterly, the CRS Quarterly, on this area as well, in the December 2000 issue. Again, that's that technical journal that we have. Well, what did the opposition say? This can't happen. I mean, the moon has been sitting there so long. What's the chance that someone's going to be looking at the sky and seeing one of these major craters? But I think it did occur. In fact, they even do calculations like this. Someone said in an astronomy book, maybe the moon gets hit by a major crater, by an impact, maybe once every million years. Okay, well, this was only 800 years ago. I rounded off to 1,000. What's the chance that in the last 1,000 years, someone saw a major crater form? Well, if you do the math, that's 1 out of 1,000. That's less than 1%. And then what's the chance that it happened in the evening when they could see it? And what's the chance that people were looking at the moon and saw it? The probability goes down to zero for this whole thing, that it was observed, at least with deep time. But it did happen. We have that eyewitness account, and people saw it. I think there's a prediction here. This moon is not as old as they say. And maybe the prediction is, we'll have another one of these days, another major impact on the moon. These craters are not billions of years old. It's happening before our very eyes. Let me just jump right out of astronomy for a minute. I know that's our major theme here this weekend, but as I think about the moon with craters that we can see occurring, and as I look at the Earth, things may not be as old as they say. So anyway, here's some other changes during our day on planet Earth. Oh, here's the old man of the mountain in New Hampshire. In fact, they had this picture on that commemorative quarter. Some of you collected all those quarters. Well, now it's all past tense. So what happened 10 years ago, 2003? The whole side of the mountain caved in and was gone. So you've got it on a quarter, but it doesn't exist. It kind of shows in dim light here, the part that caved in. This is made out of granite. This thing was said to be a monument to time. It had been there for hundreds of thousands of years at least. And it crashed down in the last 10 years. Isn't that kind of strange that it happens right here and we're here to see that? Down off the Gold Coast of Australia, the East Coast, there are these big rock formations out in the ocean. They're made out of limestone. In fact, there are 12 of them. They're called the 12 Apostles. It's just sort of a tourist mark out there. Well, guess what happened? They lost one. Now there's only 11 Apostles. The upper picture shows the one in the foreground there, the lower left, and it collapsed and is gone and crashed down. And that thing went down 2003, so that's 10 years ago as well. No, that'd be 8 years ago. That was 2005. Again, just the thought is we think about this Earth and we're told that it's unchanging and all this unending time going by, but it seems to be changing before our very eyes. The old man on the mountain collapsed. Here goes that big rock formation. I've got another one for you. Some of you have been out to Arches National Park. Wonderful area out there in Utah, and there's lots of these arches out there, and these things are said to be very old. These are, you know, erosional remnants, and you can go and see those. And there's one large one here with a 71 foot span. It kind of looks like this, and well, you got to have the picture, because this thing collapsed and this thing is gone, and the way it went just 5 years ago, nobody was under it, but it went away. If you get the point here, nature appears to be changing before our very eyes. I think all of this stuff kind of challenges these unending ages. These things, they say, have been around for hundreds of thousands of years, and then during your and my lifetime, they're collapsing. I think this is, again, just further evidence for an Earth that is not as old as they say, and it's kind of fallen apart. And God's going to have to come back and make a new heavens, a new Earth one of these days. Since I was talking about craters, let me just mention another point here. Here, just another picture of some craters on the moon. When did the moon pick up all these craters? When did all those occur? There's different ideas, and creationist astronomers are thinking about this, and we don't have the exact answer. Maybe these craters on the moon are part of creation. Maybe there's some extra debris around, and it rapidly hit the moon and made those craters way back during the creation week. Maybe those craters formed at the time of the curse. I mean, things happened then, and the whole place started to deteriorate, so maybe there was some kind of cratering effect that occurred at that time. Maybe these craters formed at the time of the flood. Now, we have a way of blaming everything on the flood, and I don't know if the flood was a cosmic, was a solar system-wide thing with even craters occurring on the moon. My goodness, for the flood, it talks about rain coming down from the sky, but I don't know about craters hitting the Earth or meteors and hitting the moon and everything else. We just kind of wonder. And we don't have all the answers in creation studies, including the origin of these craters. Maybe they were made that way. But let me just give you another suggestion here. When did the moon thoroughly get cratered? Was it creation? Was it the curse? Was it the flood? There are some indications in Scripture, especially the Old Testament, where things fall from the sky. And I was just thinking about some of those, like way back in Genesis, you know, the punishment on Sodom and Gomorrah. And I was just trying to think in my mind what might have happened back then. Now, what Scripture says is to wipe out those nasty cities, it says burning sulfur rained down from the sky. And there's some intriguing references there with the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. The angel is talking to Lot, and he says, you got to get out of town. I can't do anything until you get out of here, till you escape. What's the story there? Were these angels perhaps commissioned or authorized to bring down something from the sky to punish these cities? And, you know, maybe they shunted some of that stuff toward the moon since they had to delay things. Now, those cities still got whapped. But that's an interesting time when at least something's falling from the sky. Maybe that's part of the connection with even the cratering on the moon. Maybe all those areas fit. There's the seventh plague. Remember the 10 plagues on Egypt when it talks about lightning and hail and fire falling from the sky. And there's the battle with the Gibeonites when it says large hailstones killed more people than the sword. There are these multiple evidence in Scripture where things fell from the sky. And maybe this is part of the story as well. Maybe there's some sort of cosmic connections there, somehow connected with all these craters that we have on the moon. So anyway, we're still working on that whole area. Hey, we're taking a quick look at the moon, and we had the origin of the moon. Remember, creation makes good sense. And the age of the moon, all we talked about was lunar recession and the cratering, and we can't put an exact age on it, but those two things challenge these ancient ages for the moon. And the last one I have here is the design or the purpose of the moon. And I think this is real positive, and this is an area that I really enjoy about the whole creation movement, because we know that things don't form by chance or just accident, but there's reasons for things, including the moon. So let me ask you folks, what's the moon good for? Does it do anything for you? Would you miss it if it was gone? There are some things, aren't there? And they start to come to mind. Now, I know back in our school days, we all remember the tides and the nightlight, and those are important. But actually, the list goes on. And so I started a list here, and I think maybe we haven't begun to understand all that the moon does, but here's just a few of these ideas for us. The moon is a nightlight. Some nights it's a full moon, other nights a crescent like tonight, other nights no light at all as it goes through its phases. Now somewhere I was giving a talk and this skeptic said, come on, we don't need that nightlight of the moon, we've got flashlights. And I said, well, maybe that's true, but for a lot of people on this earth, that moonlight is important, and certainly all through history it has been important. And I was thinking of something else connected with that moonlight. I was reading an article about the germination of seeds. Now, I don't want to go off the deep end here into agriculture and all that. And we were talking about how the signs of the moon control planting and harvesting. But some research was done where they were planting, I don't know, maybe this was corn in Indiana. But for part of the field, they kept it shielded from the moonlight. They must have put something over the plants at night. That's kind of different. And the other plants, they just left open all the time. And after a certain length of time, the plants that were exposed to moonlight grew 15% faster and higher. Maybe the moonlight even helps seeds germinate and helps things grow. That'd be interesting creation research. That's an old article, and I don't know if that's been followed up or not. But there's something about this nightlight. It may be important to us, even in agriculture, things that we're not sure of. Well, the moon is so regular in its motions. It's a clock. You can tell time by it. It's a calendar. You can tell dates and seasons. You can tell direction by the moon. I just put in a bunch of C words in there. Those are all good things that the moon does. It stabilizes our seasons. We have found out in just the last about 20 years that the moon is why we have our seasons. Now, that's due to the tilt of the Earth, which is 23.5 degrees, and studies have shown that without the moon, the Earth would wobble, and the tilt would change. Now, I have the technical article here, and I really have not absorbed this. I'm still reading this whole article, but it says things like this. This is computer modeling on a high level. If the moon were not present, the Earth's tilt would be chaotic. It might vary between 50 degrees and 85 degrees. This would drastically change the climate on the Earth. Well, I guess it would. It would be out of control. We might go from winter to more severe winter. The moon even stabilizes our seasons. In fact, isn't that that verse back in Genesis that says those lights in the sky are for signs and seasons? So that's one thing the moon does that's still being looked at. Next on the list there, I have the tides as the water goes back and forth. And at the end of the list, I just put the word life. And what I really mean there is your life and mine. I think this moon is important to us in ways that we don't even think about sometimes. The tides keep the ocean going back and forth. It's a major component of the ocean currents, along with the wind and some other features. The tides keep the ocean stirred up, and that keeps the ocean healthy. Now, there's lots of life in the ocean, both the sea creatures and the plants. Are there plants in the ocean? Well, I guess there are. You have the floating plants, the plankton, the grass of the seas, they call it. And then you have, in the shallow areas, the kelp forests. And remember what plants do, how they breathe the opposite of us? They take in the CO2 and they give off oxygen. Current estimates are that the tides, the ocean, make about half of the oxygen that we breathe. So I was thinking of the scenario, what if there was no moon? Okay, well, there goes the ocean tides, and the oceans would become largely stagnant. You wouldn't want to go to the shoreline anymore. The oceans would go septic. They'd turn black. They would die with all those plants dying. Oh, there goes the plants. There goes the oxygen. There goes us. I think our very breath is dependent on the health of the ocean, on this moon that's going around the earth, and so that's your life and mine at the bottom of this list. Even in a world that's, you know, no longer perfect, it's been cursed, you can still see how God's put the whole system together for our well-being. Well, that's kind of where all this goes. The origin of the moon, creation makes good sense. The age of the moon, I think it's much younger than is often said. And the purposes go on. And I think sometimes we haven't seen the half of what God's really done with the moon and why we need it in the sky. I was just going to toss in a couple more pictures here that just are kind of fun with the moon. These eclipses. Now, here's kind of a triple picture of when the moon gets eclipsed. Remember seeing this sometimes when there's a full moon? And it doesn't disappear, but it gets kind of a reddish-brown color. This is not all that unusual. It happens once or twice every year. And it happens when the moon moves through the Earth's shadow. So we have a lunar eclipse. Those are kind of fun to look at. Then the other kind is when the sun gets eclipsed. And this picture kind of shows the sun with a bite out of it. Of course, that's the moon in the way there, even though you can't see the moon. And so it's kind of a partial eclipse. And we all recall seeing one of those as well in the past. Now, sometimes the moon can completely move in front of the sun and cover it up all the way. Then it gets dark in the daytime. I've never seen one of those. You usually got to travel to far off places to see them. When the stars come out, at least for a couple of minutes, and the moon gets in the way of the sun, a total eclipse. Maybe some of you have been there and seen one of those. It's interesting to think about this. Why is it that the moon and the sun are the same size in the sky and one can cover up the other? I mean, after all, isn't the sun a lot bigger than the moon? Well, it's about 400 times bigger, but it's also 400 times further away. And so the moon can just cover it up. This is the only place in the solar system where you have this perfect match where they can get in each other's way. I think God did that for us so we can enjoy eclipses. And this is the way that we've been able to date and unravel history as well. So eclipses of the sun are quite unusual. But let me mention, there's something interesting coming up. In fact, this is 2017. This is just 4 years from now. And we're going to have a total eclipse of the sun move right across the middle of the U.S., now, at a given place in this world, it only happens about once every 400 years. Although when it does happen, it kind of happens in bunches. So at least some of us got to hang on for 4 more years to see this next one. And if you can see, it's that narrower picture that kind of starts up there in the northwest and sweeps right across the country, and then it leaves the lower east coast there. And if you're on that path, it perhaps is 100 miles wide, give or take, you'll see a total eclipse. So that would be a good place to travel here in 4 years. And you'll hear a lot more about this in the next couple of years. You heard it here first. People are going to be buying them. Binoculars and telescopes, that might be a good stock market tip. Anyway, this thing is coming up because this total eclipse, most people haven't seen it during their lifetime, but that'll be our good chance. Now, that one doesn't go through Wisconsin. You'd have to travel south a ways, but again, we'll be hearing a lot more about this in coming months and years. So what happens if on that day, it's August 2017, what if it's like today, cloudy and rainy out? Oh, dear. It might get a little bit darker, but you'd kind of miss it. So anyway, the astronomers charter airplanes to get above all the clouds so they can see better. But anyway, it all shows God's glory and how exact all this is, how predictable it all turns out. So that's an eclipse that's coming our way. That'll be a fun thing to look forward to. Another thing that I had in my list of purposes were tides. Let me just remark on that as well here a minute, just to get kind of some practical ends. Some of you have traveled up to this part of Canada, up here in the northeast, especially the Bay of Fundy. And why does that get into a talk on the moon? Well, this is where the highest tides in the world occur. Now, that's quite a long bay. You can see across it, but it's a couple hundred miles long. And there's sort of a resonance that builds up due to the moon, the gravity pulling on the water. The water sloshes into that bay and sloshes back. And it's built up like pushing water in a tub just right so that the currents have built up. And the tides there get to be 40-some feet high. It's quite impressive. You can stand on the shoreline there and just watch the water rise up. Here's a picture on the left. I'm showing a boat in the water. Maybe high tide, and then 6 hours later with low tide, the boat is sitting on the floor of the ocean. That's quite dramatic. Some of you have been there at the Bay of Fundy to watch this. I see we have a few hands. It's a great place to look at and just watch the power of the moon's gravity pulling on the earth. Here's another picture from up there in the Bay of Fundy. This is a place called Hopewell Rocks, actually in New Brunswick. And when the tide is out, that's the color, the upper picture there, you can walk on the floor of the ocean. But you better get out of there because the water comes back and a little bit later then you need your kayak to get around. And back and forth the water goes. It's a great tourist attraction. There are some pressure there to harness this and put like a big dam across the Bay of Fundy and then get this energy of this moving water. It would be moon energy, tide energy, but that would get in the way of the tourist industry. And so the debate is going on there. I hope they leave it as it is. Hey, we had a quick look at things, the origins and the age of the moon and the purpose of the moon, and it's all good stuff. And there's a verse in Scripture that says the moon is a faithful witness to the creation. And I think it really is. Kind of a silent witness, but there it is in the sky. And all of this material we're looking at these couple of days, you know, there's a serious side to it. Romans 1:20 says we're surrounded by evidence, by God's fingerprint. And if you miss that evidence, there's just no excuse. So we can enjoy it and praise God for everything that He's made. Hey, we got just a couple minutes left before we take a stretch here. Did I leave anything uncertain here? Anything you want to ask? I don't have all the answers, but I'd be glad to try it out. Yes, sir.
Some people also say the moon started the earth revolving. It seems like if the moon was coming in such a to get the earth revolving, it would have glanced off and wouldn't have been captured. If it had come in too angular, it would have destroyed the earth.
Well, that's a question about this collision theory that's being worked on. If the moon would smack into the earth or run off the atmosphere or glance off. They're trying all these different computer models to try to make collision theory work. And again, one of them kind of comes up, well, you'll end up with two moons. But again, they have not done all the details on how this material in space would coalesce together and even make the moon. I mean, we don't see this happening in space. Nebula seem to be spreading out. So that's just, yeah, you'd have to pick very careful conditions to have even a chance for collision to work. And let me say, by the way, even if there was not a problem with fission or capture or nebula, that doesn't mean that it happened. It's just all a model. It's not reality. And in my view, the beginning was supernatural. God made the moon on the fourth day of creation, and that whole creation week was holy ground. There were miracles going on. By definition, we can't figure it out because it's beyond science. It was God's hand doing it. Yes, sir?
You were talking earlier about the moon moving away, and you had on your diagram the effects of the moon on the earth, and if it's moving away, that effect starts to deteriorate. So the question is, has anybody done any research on what effects the moon moving away has had on the earth?
Any effects of the moon moving away on the earth? Of course, the people that accept the idea of deep time, they assume the moon was much closer to us. and that the Earth was spinning faster than today. And so then they try to look in the sedimentary layers or the especially under the water to see if tides were coming more rapidly, and I see mixed evidence there. So I don't think there's not a lot of data to back up this idea. If it's true, if the moon has been doing this for a long time, the moon is going further away from the Earth, and the Earth is slowing down. So they also have to have the Earth turning faster in the past. But it's all, it's speculation.
Well, the reason I ask is when you say it's moving away, it would just be logical to assume that even if it's 1.5 inches a year, as we're talking about, that if you've got times and seasons, particularly seasons, as a turning point, people are always worried about whether the seasons and climates are changing. If the moon moves away slowly but still surely, would that not have an effect?
Well, it certainly would. If you just extrapolate this into the future, if the moon keeps going away from us, tides will diminish, they'll finally end. You know, astronomers don't have a very optimistic view of the future. I mean, not only will you lose the moon, and so the Earth will wobble, and so seasons will go crazy, but in the bigger picture, you know, in astronomy, this sun we have in the sky will sooner or later start to run out of its fuel, and it'll turn into a red giant star. It'll start to expand, and it'll burn up Mercury, Venus, planet Earth. Planet Earth will just end up being gas. It'll be gone. On a multi-billion year time scale, in consistent astronomy, they think it's all hopeless. It's all done. It's all done with. Now, I know the Lord's going to clean this Earth by fire, and the elements will melt, but it's not a red giant type star that's going to occur at all. And by the way, this whole space program, this whole idea of, you know, going out and exploring the outer planets, conquering them, and on said part of that is the thought that someday the Earth will be destroyed by the sun expanding, and so we'll have to go out to some other outer planet to live. I mean, these futurists are thinking that someday we got to move out of here. I think the Earth has other, that God has other plans for the Earth, but it's just not very optimistic when you look at the future that astronomers have. But the biblical view of the future is so encouraging. Yes, sir.
It seems like when you see a moon rise, that it appears so much larger on the horizon when it's first coming up than when it's high in the sky. Is that only a perspective issue? Because I know I've heard that it's the same size on the horizon as it is in the sky, but it always looks like when you see it coming up on the horizon and just very low, it just looks huge compared to when it's up high. Can you say anything about that?
Yes, when the moon's just coming up, it looks big, even like this picture shows. Then when it gets way up there, it's like someone let the air out of it. It gets smaller. What happened there? That's called the moon illusion. And I agree with you. That's the way it looks. But just to try a little experiment, when the moon is just coming up, if you could like take a quarter and hold it out and say, okay, the moon is about that big, a coin, and then 6 hours later when that moon's way up in the sky, measure it, it's the same size with your coin. It's sort of an illusion. When the moon is down low, you're comparing it with trees or your view of the horizon or something, and I agree, it looks big, especially in October when that big full moon comes up. But if you actually make a measurement, it's the same. When it gets up high, there's nothing to compare it with, and it kind of throws you off. You don't even believe me. You think it's bigger when it just comes up, and that's certainly the way that it looks as well. Maybe, yes, sir.
Can you say anything about when a total solar eclipse happens? Isn't that essentially like a big science experiment that allows us to see something about the sun that then opened up the study of the entire universe in terms of how stars work?
I don't know the details you're getting at, but when there's a total eclipse, there's lots of science that can be done. It's one of the chances to look at the, you know, the rim, the edge of the sun. Now, we can do that artificially these days as well by putting a shield in front, but it's a time to really check out celestial mechanics, whether the stars are exactly where they're supposed to be. When they come close to the edge of the sun, their angle is bent a little bit, so it's a time to check out some relativity details. So there's lots of science that can be done when there's an eclipse, and that total eclipse is only minutes long, so that's why the astronomers will charter airplanes to get above any clouds so that they can measure it more carefully. Maybe that's the main idea, to check the fine details of celestial mechanics and how light is bending around the sun. That's probably the idea there. Hey, one more question.
I was under the 8 feet of dust. When they landed, of course, there was only a half an inch of dust. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah, she's asking about the dust on the moon. The thought here is, if dust has continued to fall on the Earth and the moon for billions of years, there ought to be a lot of dust, even more than, you know, gets in your house, because it doesn't go anywhere. Now, on the Earth, you have weather and wind and water that can wash it away, but on the moon, it should just sort of accumulate. And in those days, back before we went to the moon, the early 60s, there were some estimates that there might be, yeah, lots of dust on the moon, maybe even many feet. Like the lander would land, the Eagle would come down to the moon, it would just disappear into the dust. They wouldn't know which way was up. They could be in trouble. But when they got to the moon, there's a couple of inches of dust. You know, it left their footprints, but that was it. Now, let me say, they were pretty sure they were going to be safe, because before we sent people to the moon, we had these surveyor craft that, without people on board, that landed on the moon, and that showed that there wasn't much dust either. But there was thought that there might still be some in certain pockets of the moon. What do you do with this argument? Is this an evidence that things aren't as old, that there wasn't all that much dust? Here's the challenge. Right up till today, we're not sure of the rate at which dust is settling on the moon and on the Earth. It seems like that would be something easy to measure, but we're not sure how much dust is coming down. On Earth here, they try to measure dust coming down to the Earth. They fly airplanes with sticky tape on them and different ways to collect it. I mean, you got to do what you can, but we don't have good values of that number. If there's not all that much dust, then okay, maybe in a billion years you would only get a couple inches. So it's kind of an open question. I didn't list it as one of my ideas of a young moon. It may be, but I'm just not sure how strong of an argument that is. There may be a lot of dust coming down, or there may be not. I guess it's one of those cases where we need more data. Although when I think about this, in an evolutionary view, where the moon and the Earth form from nebula or whatever, there should have been a lot more dust back in the early days. So even at the beginning, there should have been thicker dust. But the dust isn't there. So at least the creationist does not have a problem with that, and it's a possible problem for evolution. So it's an evidence, but probably not a strong one at this stage. One more, yes. Worrying about the moon and psychology and how that controls us, I knew I should have quit. Does the moon control the stock market and the birth rate and the death rate and the lunatic rate, all these different areas? Lots of statistical studies have been done with this, and they're all kind of inconclusive. And I'm not going to argue with somebody just like with a farmer who plants by the signs of the moon, and they say it does something there. There may be more than we know. But as far as we know with, from certainty in the area of physics, all the moon does is cause gravity, which are tides. I don't know what effect it would have on the minds. I don't think there are tides in our brains or whatever. So it remains one of those interesting open questions. Let me conclude by saying my wife, Sally, was a nurse, and she worked in the baby department. And so I would go visit them at the hospital, some night when there's a full moon, and there's lots of babies coming. And they run out of rooms, and they've got the moms up and down the hallway, and the nurses run by, and they say, "See, I told you, it's the full moon. We're having all these births." Then the very next month, there's another full moon. There's no moms. They send the nurses home. It's quiet, and nobody notices. I think it's kind of self-generating. Oh, great, now my wife Sally's going to argue with me again. So there's some things we don't know, and even that list of purposes of the moon, I'm sure there's other purposes we haven't found out yet. I'm sure that a full moon might have an effect on someone who wants to do a crime or something, but any other effect that we have, I don't know, I leave that to you. Hey, thank you, folks.
Thank you, Don. Probably my introduction, I forgot to mention an important aspect of Dr. DeYoung. He happens to be the president of the Creation Research Society, and he served on the CRS Board of Directors for, Don, help me, 27 years, 30 years? Yeah, long time, very nice. Before I turn this back to Dr. Heck, I just want to make you aware of a couple things. First of all, there are additional restrooms. My colleague, Dr. Ferguson, told me there are 128 restrooms at CUW.